Hey guys, welcome to the Martial and Healing Arts channel. I'm Rafe Kelly, founder of Evolve Move Play. I'm extremely excited to be sponsoring this channel. Martial and Healing Arts have been key aspects of embodiment and self-cultivation for thousands of years. I have some of my best friends in the industry, Rory Miller, Matt Thornton, Edward Hines, presenting here, and I'm really excited to share what they have to say with you guys. You're gonna love it. So Evolve Move Play is an ecology of practices of movement, mindfulness, nature connection, and community. And within the movement, we have a big emphasis on moving in nature and being able to do parkour. We also like to lift weights and throw things around, but there's a huge aspect of martial arts, and I've been training martial arts since I was 6 years old. So it's really exciting to be able to sponsor this channel in particular. If you're interested in my work, check out my talks on the Main Stage and the Movement Anatomy channel. If you can't get to either of those live, you can check us out at Rafe Kelly on Instagram. Get all your awesome embodiment giveaways. And for now, just enjoy this amazing channel. It's going to be an awesome show.
Okay, introducing to you all for Sean here, I would like to say a quote that I believe in, that you never come across an amazing person with an easy past. So Sean, in 2010, he started shifting his focus from science to meditation after going through a severe breakdown. And then on his journey, he also picked up his journey with martial arts, with jiu-jitsu, in 2011. And then in 2017, he went through another severe transition in which he realized that he has been a victim of child sexual abuse by his father, which took him on a different path altogether to explore his connection with the martial arts and mindfulness. And in 2018, he came up with the idea of mindful martial arts, which he represents, and he's going to be talking about today to us about trauma-informed martial arts, how he developed mindful martial arts through his journey and his 10-year commitment to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and mixed martial arts. And he will also be sharing details on creating a trauma-informed martial arts practice and speaking to us about his journey. Any questions that you would have, we will request you to put in the question answer box, and you can also upvote the questions if that's a question coming up into your head. And any technical queries, you can just type it directly to us. And yeah, I will hand this over to Sean.
Thank you so much, Rafe. Okay, so I'm Sean Desjardins, the founder of Mindful Martial Arts. Again, it's a trauma-informed self-defense and martial arts program in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. The aim of Mindful Martial Arts is to help develop and strengthen people, not only in their confidence to be able to defend themselves, but to develop into people of strength and integrity within this world. The stresses that we experience in training combat and training martial arts very much correlate to the stresses that we experience outside in the world. Personal stresses, relationship stress, work stress. So the way that we approach training martial arts, if we do it mindfully and we do it with a sense of earnest effort and understanding of the way that our bodies work, it translates to how we approach challenges in our lives. There's a direct correlation between how we experience stress martial arts and how we experience stress outside of martial arts. So I'll start with just kind of a quote around, you know, peace does not come from the absence of challenge, but through the capacity to skillfully navigate challenges in your life. And that's very much a tenet of mindful martial arts. I talk about trauma-informed framework in the context of martial arts. This is something that's just starting to pop up around the world. I've had different practitioners from around the world contact me and say like, hey, like we don't really see this. We don't really see trauma informed narratives being like penetrating the world of martial arts. So let me talk to you a little bit about how that works in the context of mindful martial arts. First, I'll say that mindful martial arts is like a multi-phase system, is a multi-phase system. So we start off by learning techniques of mindfulness. And through learning techniques of mindfulness, we transition into self-defense practice. The reason why we transition into self-defense practice before any kind of sparring or combative practice is because it gives us the opportunity to start to work with our training partners in a collaborative environment. So that collaborative environment is really important in general, but especially to trauma survivors. Trauma survivors didn't have the opportunity to have safe and supportive environments when they went through their trauma. And so establishing a sense of trust amongst the participants is actually primary and most important. It's in this period of time that people can start to practice skills that help them not only in training their martial arts, but in their life, like how to communicate your boundaries. Choice is very much encouraged in mindful martial arts. Meaning that, you know, if you are uncomfortable with a scenario or you feel unsafe with a scenario, I encourage you to speak out and to speak your limitations so that they can be respected. And that goes for every participant in the mindful martial arts program. It's communication is foundational in trying to figure out how we can respect each other and co-create an environment that's best for everyone. Self-defense also reduces the complexity and the intensity of training combat so that participants can actually start to integrate the techniques at an intensity that doesn't bring them into a state of overwhelm. So very much we use the concept of the window of tolerance. If you are aware of trauma theory, I'm sure you know what that is, but if you've never heard of the window of tolerance, I'll give you just a quick demonstration. So the window of tolerance is a range of experiences where you can think and feel simultaneously. So it's in this range of experience that you actually have free choice. Your frontal cortex is online and you're processing reality. You are gaining adaptive information about your environment, about yourself. You are regulated enough to be learning. Now, when stress is so intense or trauma is triggered, oftentimes people get shot out of the window of tolerance either above into hyperarousal, so anger and fear and rage, or hypoarousal below, which could be states of feeling depressive or kind of shameful or submissive. Either way, as you head further away from the window of tolerance, your capacity for free choice is diminished and these natural animalistic self-defense mechanisms take over. I'm sure you've heard of fight or flight. So on the hyperarousal end, fight, flight, and potentially freeze. Same thing on the hypo, freeze and submit. These are natural self-defense mechanisms that have been embedded into the human being from millions of years of evolution, from being reptiles and growing up and growing and evolving through challenging environments. They still exist within us to this day. Let me go back. There we go. So this window of tolerance is a gauge for us to try to determine, when are we experiencing stress that's adaptive and helps us grow? And when are we experiencing stress that's actually destructive? By tracking that, we can really see when we're helping participants to grow and when we're actually potentially stifling their growth. Starting with this kind of framework around mindfulness and self-defense is so important, and to build these skills and these fundamental techniques in a range where people can actually manage the stress of them, it not only allows it to be like more effective, but it makes it sustainable, it makes it fun. And then from that point, we can grow our practice by adding, I like to call it adding monkey wrenches. So what that means is we add a little bit more challenge so that your technique becomes a little bit more robust, becomes a little bit more resilient. And we do it in a systematic way, being mindful the entire time of the window of tolerance and ensuring that we stick to our values of respecting each other and communicating. I think it's really important to create an environment in which there's trust and respect as a foundation of martial arts. That foundation can bring us so far forward when we choose to go as far as we want to go, whether it's into light sparring or live sparring or into the competitive world as far as we want to go. So I'm going to give you a little hypothetical situation. And I want to kind of get maybe a response if it's possible to see how people feel about it. So let's just say that, and maybe you guys can relate to this, maybe you're somebody who's grown up and you've always felt uncertain or uncomfortable with the potential of physical confrontation. Maybe there's been periods in your life where you didn't speak up for yourself, or you didn't feel even capable of speaking up for yourself, or speaking up for another person, because there was this fear of maybe physical confrontation could happen, or somebody could bully you, or something of that nature. Maybe you even experienced violence around you when you were younger, and it still holds kind of a grip on you. So let's say you choose to go and empower yourselves through learning self-defense and martial arts. It's a great decision. But your first day, you go to a school and you learn some, you know, one or two techniques, and then they start you sparring with some students. The first person that you're paired up with is significantly larger than you and has a lot of experience. And what they do is they beat the crap out of you until you can't continue. And then they yell at you for not being able to continue. Do you think that that's a reasonable kind of way to approach learning martial arts? Or is that the kind of school that you might want to go to? You can leave it the comments in the chat if you feel to respond. The reason why I bring up this hypothetical is because that's what I experienced my first time doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a self-defense martial art that stems from Japanese Judo. It's based in self-defense. It's mainly grappling. But it's meant so that a smaller, weaker opponent can defeat a larger, more aggressive opponent using technique, using timing, using skill. And yeah, it's an extremely effective martial art, but I truly believe that there's a better way to go about it than what I experienced my first time. So I want to tell you more about mindful martial arts. Before I do so, I think it's really important for me to tell you a little bit more about this guy, Sean Desjardins, because me, Sean, and mindful martial arts are inextricably linked. Our histories are intertwined. So I'll start from the beginning. I was born in 1987 in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. My mother's Italian descent and my father's French Canadian. I lived in Montreal for 2 years before moving to Newmarket, Ontario, which is just a small kind of city or town north of Toronto. I grew up in Newmarket for 6 years. I started playing ice hockey as Canadians do. I started to take an interest in academics, but kind of abruptly, when I was 8 years old, 1996, my father got promoted and he moved us to Atlanta, Georgia. It was kind of a jarring thing for me. I just had some stability as a child, and next thing I know, I'm being moved into a new circumstance. I didn't feel like I was really prepared for it. So it kind of took a hit on my confidence, but you know, you're a child, you're young, you're resilient, you figure out a way forward. So we ended up in Atlanta, Georgia for 6 years. And it was in this period of time that I became very invested in competitive hockey. I was a goalie. I loved being in that position of high intensity, you know, puck coming at me and the last line of defense, you know, all the kind of the weight on my shoulders. And simultaneously, I gained an interest in music, as well as academics. I did well in science and mathematics. I remember in the third grade, my teacher, Mrs. Banks, called my mother because all day long I would be banging on my desk. And she actually called my mother and basically forced her to buy me a drum set because I was driving her insane. So that started my forte into music, and those passions and hobbies are still with me to this day. Very kind of fundamental to my nature. So unfortunately, in this period of time when I was around 12 or 13 years old, my parents divorced. And again, it was kind of an abrupt scenario. I feel like I was going to school, I was playing sports, and all of a sudden my parents had split. And very quickly, I was living in a different neighborhood with my mother and my brother. And then by the beginning of that summer, my mom decided to move back to Canada away from my father. And again, I had this, you know, abrupt situation where I found myself basically in a new environment, and this time without my father, which I think really took a hit to my sense of security and self-confidence. So Yeah, basically, I moved to a suburb of Toronto again, and I started high school. And when I started high school, my interest started to change. I became less invested in competitive sports and academics. Even though I was intelligent and I was gifted in those areas, I think I started to feel a little bit like kind of hard done by life. And I started smoking marijuana. I started drinking. I started to get into counterculture. I played in a punk band. I was skateboarding. And I really lost my focus in the direction that I was going in at the time. I also had some mental health challenges surface for me, like a lack of self-esteem, self-confidence, and some anxiety and depression that was surfacing when I was a teenager. I was clever enough to maintain decent enough grades to get into a decent school, a decent university. And in 2005, I went to a school called McMaster University for engineering. And it was in this time that those coping mechanisms that I developed as a teenager started to kind of run away from me. I found myself smoking marijuana all the time, pretty much from the time I woke up to the time I went to sleep. I also really did not take care of my responsibilities in a way that was that made sense. Like, I basically stayed up all night and I slept all day. I skipped most of my classes. I spent a lot of my time playing music, being high, avoiding my responsibilities. And yeah, those coping mechanisms really took a toll on me, as well as my mental health. I started developing more anxiety, more depression, and kind of receded into greater and greater sense of isolation. I didn't care about how to be a good technical drawer for engineering or like what the equation was to bend a beam, because truly I felt like I was suffering and it didn't matter to me. I wanted to understand how the world worked. I wanted to understand why the world felt so dark to me. And, you know, these engineering classes gave me nothing. So I kind of escaped into isolation and smoking marijuana. And really the one thing that I was invested in was becoming strong. So from the age of 14, throughout my entire life, I've been, you know, in the gym, lifting weights and training. And that's where I put most of my energy, even in university, to be honest. I also became quite interested in fighting. I used to watch mixed martial arts in university, and especially an organization called Pride in Japan, which was a mixed martial arts organization where they would put on crazy events like, you know, 16 man tournaments where, you know, the champion would have to fight four times in a night, or a 400 pound man fighting a 200 pound man. And just some of the courage and the bravery that I saw in some of those combative situations were just inspiring to me. Like, how can you go into such an adverse scenario and face such adversity with such calmness and such resilience? And in particular, a fighter named Fedor Emelianenko, who was the heavyweight champion for 10 years, he was stoic, he was humble, he was so impressive in his ability to face adversity that it really inspired me. I wanted to be somebody who was like that, you know? Unfortunately, as time went on, these coping mechanisms got the best of me, and I found myself unable to continue with my studies. I remember one year I basically didn't go to any class, and then midterms came and I was like, oh, I'm going to fail everything because I have done nothing. And I realized that, you know, I had a breakdown and I realized I couldn't continue in that way. So I took a leave of absence and I started to think about what the heck is going on. Like, why am I not able to push forward with my life? And I started to reflect on that. I was always interested in science because that was the modality that was given to me. So I was looking out into the world, like, how does this work? How does that work? I was researching cosmology, astrophysics. And it wasn't until I found quantum physics, where there's this observer effect. It's basically when you shoot, let's say, a photon, a light particle, through two slits in a plane, whether you observe it or not determines whether it acts like a particle or a wave. So the act of observation changes the material reality. And to me, this was this aha moment of like, oh, this guy, you know, not just out there, but like, what's going on in here? And that led me into philosophy. And philosophy, I meandered into Eastern philosophy, where I learned about meditation and about a different perspective of the world, a perspective of the world in which there's a holistic union, you know, the human being, Jean Desjardins, is not an alien that was implanted on the world and trying to figure out this alien thing that sometimes science feels like. I am as much the world as anything else, as a tree, as a plant, as any other animal, you know, I'm of this world. And that perspective gave me some solace. And somehow I got siphoned into some of the mystics that existed throughout time, in particular, a man named Sri Ramana Maharshi, who was an Indian mystic who spent 20 years basically meditating on a mountain in solitude and eventually became a teacher. And he spoke of self, capital S self, as a eternal, you know, luminous self that exists beyond the body, beyond the individual sense of self, beyond the story of self. And I became obsessed with this idea, and I chased it through pursuing meditation like a crazy person. Every moment of the day that I had, that I didn't have to take all my attention, I was meditating throughout university, the end of my university, and after. And, you know, what it did for me was I started to gain sensitivity to myself and to the world. And in that sensitivity, I gained so much insight. But at the same time, it was so overwhelming, because all this mental health challenges, all this anxiety, all this fear and depression, and everything that was going on in the world, it started to impact me even on a deeper level. And I remember it became so overwhelming that what I did to cope with that is I doubled down on meditation and I isolated myself into nature. And so I remember spending days meditating, and I felt like I was on the cusp of something. Like I was meditating and I would get to this place of stillness, and then all this fear and anxiety would surface. And I didn't know how to get past it. So being an engineer, being clever, but not necessarily wise, I concocted a solution, which was I was gonna drink a beer to calm myself down. I was going to smoke a tiny bit of weed. Those were my tools. And that was going to help me, you know, get past this hurdle. So one day I walked into the forest and I sat by a creek and I drank one beer. I had a couple tokes of weed and I sat in meditation. And this time when I sat, my thought went completely still. No thought, nothing. And my body was still. And in that stillness, my identity disappeared. The story of who I was no longer there. And what emerged was this luminous experience of a unified reality that was free and joyous and whole and complete. I spent, I don't know how much time in this experience, because this experience is beyond time. Without the movement of thought through the human being, the experience of time, it's not there. It's an eternal moment. And so however long I spent in this moment, I remember the first thought that came into awareness, it was something that was foreign. It was an object for me. I had only known thoughts about myself. I had only known thoughts about my story, about who I was. And now I found something different, something deeper. And the first thought that came into existence was now something I could see as separate, like, oh, it's an object. And I remember as I left this experience, I was in bliss. I was in pure bliss. And I saw an old man and a small child walking in the opposite direction of me. When I saw the small child, I saw one that was in the state that I was in. He was in a state of openness, trust, freedom, exploration, curiosity. And the old man was terrified. He was contracted. He was scared. He was carrying so much weight. And I remember just feeling that, feeling the impact of that and how impactful that was. And I left the forest and I had a period of life that was the most fluid and graceful I'd ever experienced in my life. It was just like I understood everything so deeply for a period of time that that there was no conflict. I was barely thinking. I was just flowing through life. Unfortunately, as time went on, I lost all interest in worldly things, my relationships, my aspirations. I started to really want to chase and hold on to this experience that I had of this blissful, non-dual, self. And eventually my relationships broke down. And I started to experience a kind of intensity of mental health challenges that I never experienced in my life. Panic, and like almost like my body was shaking with fear and anxiety. And I didn't understand what was going on. I honestly thought I was dying or that I was deathly ill. I would check myself into the hospital at times and they would say like, nope, you're good, And so I didn't know what the heck was happening. And it was around this time that I started training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I had the experience that I mentioned in the beginning of getting beaten up by a giant dude on my first day without knowing anything. Jiu-Jitsu gave me so much. Jiu-Jitsu gave me the ability to defend myself and the capacity to fight. And I really valued that. And it was so important to me. Like, it gave me a confidence that I never had. In spite of all my weightlifting and my muscles at the time, I'd gotten into all these like situations in which people tried to rob me, chase me with a knife, jump me, like half a dozen to a dozen scenarios throughout my teenage and early adult years where I was in, combative situations, like wrong place, wrong time. When I started training, they disappeared. I didn't have anything like that happen to me. And I just had this confidence to go after things that I never had in my life. So jiu-jitsu gave me so much. At the same token, I did a tournament, my first tournament as a white belt in Detroit, Michigan. I won my first tournament, felt empty after. I got my blue belt in 8 months. That was great. But I struggled with panic attacks and mental health and depression while I was training. It's like something about it wasn't good for me, for a part of me. But when I stopped training, I felt 10 times worse. So I pushed through. Now, fast forward, this is around 2012. In 2013, I left the city I was living in and I went on an adventure to BC. I went tree planting. So for those Canadians who know what tree planting is, basically I lived in a tent for several months and I smashed trees into the ground for 12 hours a day. It was in this period of time that I remember collecting cardboard boxes to put on the forest ground to teach people jiu-jitsu. I went on an adventure rock climbing after tree planting, and then I hitchhiked to Vancouver, and then I flew to the Yukon to go on this 700 kilometer long canoe trip. I went on an epic adventure with some friends that I had met recently, and I went through all kinds of inspirational things and challenges. I saw, grizzly bears and moose, and we had like literally a paper map that was laminated, one paper map between three canoes and seven people, and no access to like phones or anything. And I had never canoed in my life, so I was learning how to canoe on this trip. And we were just wild. But eventually I ended up in a small town called Dawson City. And it was in Dawson City that I started to work as a bouncer at a bar and simultaneously at a daycare during the day. So that kind of dichotomy of those, like the combat and then like the taking care of children, or that dichotomy followed me my entire life. I started a jiu-jitsu school in the Yukon. I posted like little, pamphlets around the town saying who wants to train jiu-jitsu. And I found one man who wanted to train. And next thing I know, I got connected to the rec center and they gave me old kimonos and old mats. And I started a free class where people wanted to train jiu-jitsu. So at this point, I had lived in a tent, a single person tent, for 6 months that year. And it was starting to get really cold, like negative 10, negative 15 at night. And I moved into a trailer, which was even colder because there was no heat. And at a certain point, I found myself alone in the Yukon, wondering, what the hell am I doing here? My mental health was really struggling. I was going through periods of, again, anxiety and depression and dissociation. And I went back home to stay with my mother because basically my mental health deteriorated. And that kind of pattern of going on an adventure and trying to establish some stability and roots, and then mental health challenges surfacing, that repeated for me again and again in my life. After that, I went to Central America, to Panama, and I taught English for a few months. I was training jiu-jitsu. Same thing happened. Mental health to such a degree that, like, yeah, I was having suicidal thoughts. I couldn't function. Like, I couldn't function at all. Like, I remember being in a taxi cab to go to work, and I remember my eyes were closed, and opening my eyes to take in reality was too much. That was already too much for me. So finally, I went home, back to my mother's place, and I decided to look for some professional help. I found a psychiatrist, and I'm going to give a little warning here, on a site called ratemds.com. So this psychiatrist had a great rating, you know, 5 stars, amazing, everyone loved him. Found out later on that site, basically, you can pay several hundred dollars a month to remove negative reviews. So there's no integrity involved in it. And I learned that after the fact when I left a negative review and it disappeared. So just be wary of that if you ever use that site. So yeah, I found the psychiatrist, and he was, you know, alternative in his method. He didn't believe in the pharmaceutical approach. It was more about, you know, emotions and speaking. So I was like, okay, I'm in. The first time I sat down in front of him, I never felt understood like I did in that moment. I felt like I sat in front of somebody who completely understood me. And so I started to open up, and I remember, like, the first time I cried in front of somebody in I don't know how long. And yeah, so I had this moment of like, oh my God, somebody like gets it. But what happened shortly after is I started to notice like some really concerning things. Manipulative techniques, berating his patients, inviting patients into sessions without, like, oh yeah, come into this person's session. Like, there was this like boundaryless atmosphere that was created. And anyone who had a real problem, he basically just completely ignored it and focused on like basically teaching people how to manipulate each other. He would talk about like, you know, seducing people and like that being a strategy to get what you want. So what I realized happened is that I formed a trauma bond with this person, Stockholm syndrome, if that's more familiar to you. And the reason why he understood me, I felt so understood, is because we probably had some similar life experiences, traumatic experiences. Unfortunately, it escalated to a point where he started inviting patients, including myself, outside of the office, and, you know, telling people like, oh, I'm going to this festival, I think it would be good for you, but just don't tell anyone I'm your psychiatrist. And then he would become extremely abusive, not physically, but emotionally and verbally, and systematically destroying people's sense of choice and sense of self. So I experienced another huge breakdown when that happened, and I left the care of this person. And when that happened, I started to have memories surface from what I realized to be now my childhood of being raped and sexually abused as a kid, as a very young child. And basically what had happened with this psychiatrist is that the same things that were done to me, the grooming process, were the same as what happened to me when I was a kid. And so there was a familiarity, and there was this kind of bond that I formed, that I realized I formed with my father when I was very young. And I started to have these memories come back of this abuse. But at the time it was a lot of confusion, and like, I didn't really know it was true. It was just an inkling, like, I think something happened, you know? As time went on, that became stronger and stronger. The knowing that it happened became stronger. I started doing therapy. I got destabilized to the point, like, trying to work through it, where, you know, there were so many times where I had suicidal thoughts and suicidal like feelings, that out of desperation, I did something called ayahuasca, which is a Central American, South American kind of psychedelic medicine, you know. But what it did for me really was it opened up more trauma, and I was already at my limit. And at the time, I was doing a full-time master's in mechanical engineering and working 30 hours a week, and I was above my means of paying for my apartment, and boom, more trauma opens up. I didn't really have a good support system at all. So basically, it fractured me. And in that fracturing, I started having parts of myself that were, you know, suppressed from my entire life, from childhood sexual abuse, surface. And I didn't have the capacity to deal with them. I started having these suicidal impulses where I would literally be like, one time I was on my brother's balcony on the sixth floor, and I was in such turmoil, I went to get some fresh air, and I found myself midway through throwing myself off the balcony. It's like the impulse to die was so strong that I had to like catch myself. When I found that out, I knew that I wasn't going to survive unless I did something really drastic. So I checked myself into CAMH, which is a mental hospital here in Toronto. I was put on antipsychotics, antidepressants. Oh yeah, heavy experience. And yeah, I basically was in a hospital for early psychosis for about a month. And in that time, what I saw was traumatized people. You know, everyone who was in that psychosis ward was a traumatized person, severely traumatized. And yet the model was, oh, what symptoms are you having? Oh, you have symptoms? Okay, let's like repress those with intense medication. And if they're repressed enough or suppressed enough, then you should be good. Their only concern was, you know, what are your symptoms? And I knew I went through trauma. So I was trying to advocate to them like, hey, I've been through something. I want to heal. I don't know how to do this. All the narrative they gave me was, are you experiencing symptoms? And if I said yes, it would give me more medication and numb my capacity to feel. And if I said no, they thought, okay, you're doing well. You know, maybe you could be functional. So I ended up leaving on my own. And I took myself off that medication on my own because the system that existed did not fit my narrative of healing and of what life is, you know? I believe that inherently everyone can heal. It's what, you know, nature wants. So I don't need the suppression or the Western medicine to suppress my symptoms. I need to find a way to work through them. And I found a trauma therapist who I guess was more aligned. And at this time, I'd also changed careers from engineering to being a personal trainer. And I'm going to skip through a bit of the story just because of time. I know there's so much to the story, but I basically made a transition from being an engineer to personal training. And then I became obsessed with being the greatest martial artist in the world. I don't know if it sounds silly or not, but like it's something that came through me. It was like, that's all I care about. I just want to be the greatest martial artist in the world. And so I started to chase it. I left the partnership that I was in at the time. I left my personal training business and the work that I was doing, packed all my shit into a car, and I moved to Montreal to train at TriStar Gym, which is the best gym in Canada for mixed martial arts. George St. Pierre, Rory McDonald. If you know MMA, it's like the pinnacle of MMA. And when I had left for Montreal, I had enough space from my immediate surroundings that I realized that I was sexually abused as a child and I needed to confront my family. And so I did. And when I did, unfortunately, nobody took responsibility. Nobody acknowledged what happened. And to survive emotionally, I cut my family out of my life. With the boundary that you will not have a meaningful relationship with me until you're willing to talk about this. When that happened, my mental health went again to the bottom. But this time I didn't have a support system. I wasn't able to go stay at my mom's place or, you know, have a place to go. So what happened was I started running out of money, couldn't find a job. I was in Montreal, I was in a foreign place. I didn't really know anyone or not that many people. And I basically was going to be homeless. So I decided like, I'm either going to go into the shelter system, the youth shelter system, and just keep fighting, you know, not only from my life, but, you know, martial arts, or I'm going to try to go back home to Toronto and see if I can get some help. I chose to call upon some friends. Unfortunately, everyone that I was like the most close with at the time, including family, basically said no, like, we can't take you in. And yeah, it was the most vulnerable period of my life, one of the most vulnerable periods of my life anyways. And I was lucky enough to have maintained connection with some friends from high school and university who I was close with, but not so much at that period of time. And my good friend Hewitt Z, took me into his one bedroom apartment for 4 months, fed me, gave me a place to sleep, supported me in all kinds of ways. My friend Arun Murthy, who is like, I don't know, a godsend of a person, man. I don't understand how people are made that well. But he, you know, was patient and empathetic and listening to what I was going through and supported me the entire way through and even lent me thousands of dollars so that eventually I could find a room and a home and start, like, you know, to live on my own again. In this period of time, I was doing trauma therapy. I was understanding trauma. And at the same token, I moved directly adjacent to a mixed martial arts gym. So I continued to train mixed martial arts. What I experienced was there was days when I was so downtrodden and overwhelmed and beyond my capacity from doing this deep trauma work. I would go into train mixed martial arts and I would talk to my partners and I would say, look, I'm in a rough spot. I just want to go light. I just want to, you know, be on the mats. First time I did that, my partner literally was like, yeah. And then came at me like it was a life or death struggle and tried to, you know, choke me out. I thought, wow, like my words aren't respected at all. So I went and I talked to the coach. I told the coach. And basically one of the coaches just called me a pussy and then ignored me. And so the next day, I went up to this coach when we were sparring and I said, hey, look, are you willing to go, you know, full intensity this sparring session? And he laughed at me because he thought it was a joke. And so basically I got him into a choke and I started choking him, you know, until he would tap or went unconscious in front of his girlfriend who was sitting there and in front of all the other students. But before he tapped or went unconscious, I let go of the choke because the thing was, this is not about winning and losing. This is about creating a safe environment to train where I'm respected. I can go to this place if I need to. I can go to this intense combative place, but it's not good for me. So, you know, I found that there was this pattern of like, people only respected domination. Went to another gym, trained mixed martial arts. My first day there, you know, hey, it's my first time back training mixed martial arts. You know, I'd like to, you know, just start light. A professional fighter came after me and started throwing bombs at me. And so I realized like, oh, if I meet his intensity, we're going to brawl. And that's exactly what I don't want. So I had to survive this, you know, onslaught. And eventually I realized like, this guy's considered cool. You know, like the environment is such that like, this is the cool guy. And I'm like, again, there's no integrity in that. So I left. I probably have been in 12 gyms in my life, maybe more. I never found what I was looking for. Never found a place where, it's emotional for me. I never found a place where the value system of integrity and compassion and, you know, really a community of people helping each other grow in a healthy way, a sustainable way existed. And so I stopped looking. I just started to train on my own, hours and hours and hours a day. I would just go do footwork, basic drills, bag work. And eventually, while doing all this healing work, this trauma work, I found a few friends who, you know, were doing self-development, meditation, healing, inner work. And they also had a history of combative experience and training. And we started to train together. We talked about our feelings and we talked about, you know, what our limitations were. And we still trained hard, but we found ways in which to respect each other and to communicate that with each other. Not long after that, I found a way to get into a gym that was nearby. I walked in off the street. I talked to the manager. I said, look, this is who I am. This is what I want to do. This is who I've trained with. Shook my hand. And I started to be able to rent this gym to start to train my friends. Eventually that turned into mindful martial arts. So what the hell is mindful martial arts? Mindful martial arts is basically, the truth is, I don't really know what mindful martial arts is, but I can tell you some aspects of it. I don't know what it is yet, you know, but basically I focus on trying to build people up and make them more resilient and to help them overcome their challenges, not only in martial arts, but in life. And the way that I do that in some sense is like, I pay attention to, I use the trauma theory, window of tolerance, you know, like, are they growing? Are they learning? Are they integrating their experiences? Are they developing in their value system? Are they becoming better people? Are they becoming stronger people? Or are they breaking down? And are they becoming more violent? Are they becoming more short-tempered? Are they becoming, you know, submissive? Are they not feeling the courage to speak out for themselves? We encourage communication. Stand up for yourself, you know, respect yourself, speak for yourself. And if you can't do it, I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you learn how to do that. I also think that self-defense is really important without shitting on other martial arts. Try not to shit on other martial arts. It's really important to have a realistic sense of being able to defend yourself physically. You can practice all day long on a bag or do forms, but until you feel what that's like with some resistance, it's hard to really know what your capacity is. And when you know what your capacity is through testing it, you embody it. You carry it with you. It's with you in a way that stays with you, and it's felt. It's felt by your entire environment. And so that's why it's really important to move in that direction and to practice self-defense in a real sense, not like, you know, some martial arts turn into sports. And sports are wonderful, but sports are not self-defense. You can't punch in jiu-jitsu tournaments. You can't take people down in kickboxing tournaments. Just a realistic sense of self-defense is really important. Also, self-defense is kind of, the intensity of it is reduced so that you can actually practice your techniques in a way where you could be regulated and integrate your knowledge and learn. And you can build upon that. You can pay attention to your window of tolerance and mindfully increase your capacity to experience greater challenges and have a robustness to yourself and your techniques. I feel like I can say so much more, but I kind of want to open it up to see if anyone wants to share or speak or have questions while we still have time. I think that would be a great idea. I want to say more, but I have an intuition that maybe like to invite some people in if they feel.
It's really amazing, Sean. I could see some comments from Georgia as well. She has been training in jiu-jitsu, and she has some amazing insights.
Yeah, I would love to. If anyone has any questions, I'd invite them in now. If not, I'm happy to keep going. I'm like, you know, feel the momentum.
Yeah, we were wondering. Your flow is incredible. I mean, I was just so absorbed in your story. So, yeah, if you want to keep sharing with us, please keep going. I would also like to ask, like, how does a network work for you? You know, the network of maybe did you find other people or in the field who had gone through similar experiences and that bonds you in a bit, or there's a network or a community that you all found similar, lacunas in the way the system was working?
I mean, aside from the friends that I met at the beginning of this journey, what happened to me is I took on the role of a teacher. So because I couldn't really find what I was looking for, I started to create it. And when I created it, I was the spearhead. I was the person in charge. So very much so, like, I went to train in environments that weren't ideal for me, so I could integrate that knowledge. And, you know, I trained with professional mixed martial artists, and I put myself in scenarios where, you know, there was risk. But ultimately, I became the teacher. So I was the one kind of collecting knowledge and sharing it the best that I could. I also invited some professional amateur fighters that I trained with to come into my environment over a period of time, which was interesting to try to, you know, get them to calm down a little bit and slow down and be a little bit more mindful. And it was an interesting experience. Like, I think that maybe people don't know through their intellect, but they can feel what it's like when there's a deep sense of respect in the environment. Like, they walk away feeling happy. Like, they're not traumatized, you know? They don't walk away. Like, so often in combat sports, people, you know, they win and blah, blah, blah. And they kind of, like, they go into a part of themselves that's unconscious. I talk about outside the window of tolerance, the fight part, the, you know, the rage, the, or the submissive part on the loser's end. But without kind of bringing your value system and your integrity with you into those places and learning how to integrate them, you can kind of just infinitely re-traumatize people. So it's really important to develop that foundation, and from that foundation to expand into these places, because there's gold in those places, you know, in some of the darker places of human experience. But we can't go there without a light. And the light is the practice of mindfulness and communication and our value system.
Yeah, so thank you for that, Sean. I think there's a question, Georgia. Anna, can we bring Georgia to the screen?
Yeah, that'd be sick.
Yes. She has been looking forward to this.
Welcome, Georgia.
Hello.
Georgia, I think you need to mute.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Hi. Oh, thank you so much for sharing that, because frankly, I don't think there's been any questions because you shared so beautifully. We were all just really invested in listening to you. So yeah, I'm a bit shaky at the moment, forgive me. I feel like my questions are a little bit inadequate, to be honest. But a lot of what your story said resonated. Not the same trauma, I will say. And I actually think that your whole story will resonate very strongly with my partner as well. He's the one who got me involved in jiu-jitsu. In fact, I don't know if you can see my gi back there. Okay.
Yeah.
And I only just started kind of before the pandemic, so I didn't really get to have much involvement in it. And it's a bit overwhelming being a 5'1" girl in a gym full of men. I will say that my luck was is that the gym I was involved in was SBG Belfast, your straight blast gym.
Yeah.
And the head of the gym was fantastic and very inclusive, so the community spirit was definitely there, so I think I was lucky. However, that was in Belfast, and I'm actually in Wales, and there's a much smaller gym here with just men, and I'm very nervous about kind of going in there on my own, and a lot of chronic health problems, so I love that whole slow roll, you know, flow roll then. And I don't know how, as you said, like, you know, you go in there, it's not that I expect to be just flattened. Maybe I'd be luckier because I'm a girl, but how did you manage to make that connection? I mean, you did it yourself, so you just started training with your friends, and that's obviously brilliant. And I'm rambling a lot, sorry. Didn't expect to do this, to be honest. But yeah, how, I mean, I'm very limited. There's only one gym in this area. So yeah. Do you think it's possible to try and get people to pay attention to that and not just go, you know, bull seeing red flag, I guess?
What I can give you is what I did when I was in scenarios or gyms that I didn't feel like embodied this like value system that I hold now. So basically, oftentimes I could find at least one other person who I felt like was on my wavelength. Yeah. So, you know, I would say one, don't undervalue your voice. If it doesn't feel right, speak out. And you always have an opportunity to say no.
Stop.
Have that culture, you know, where it's like, oh, I'm the instructor. You should do this. You should do that. You know, like I was in a gym not too long ago, but the instructor like basically was swearing at students. And then I told them to fuck off, you know, because it's like, yeah, fuck you. Like, I don't care. You can beat me up, but I'm still not going to stand for it, you know? And I think, yeah, just don't undervalue your voice. Like, if it's not right, speak out. And if you can find one training partner or two training partners who you resonate with, and you can communicate with them and be like, hey, look, this is where I'm at. This is what I'm looking for. I think that could be a strategy to kind of move towards training in a way that feels fruitful for you. You know, if it's not working for you, like, don't be afraid to say, I'm not with it, or no, thank you. That would be my first thing. Second thing is, you know, get them to have mindful martial arts, give them a seminar in trauma-informed martial arts. I'll come, you know. I'm happy to tell
that
them.
That would be amazing.
I'm happy to help them out to make the context more inclusive and helpful for more people. But well, yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I'm going to definitely introduce you to the ones in Belfast, because I think they would resonate with you heavily. I mean, they are about your ideals, and definitely about it's being a safe place, basically. And there's free communication there. So I miss being there. Obviously, I haven't been there since Christmas. I suppose on another note, though, if it's okay to ask another question, you might have other questions from other people. But in regards to your journey from discovering,
let you know, there's a coffee chat room. Anna is going to post a link, and just after the session, we can move to that room to continue any conversations and any queries about Sean. Yeah.
Feel free as well. You can contact me through my website, which is posted, mindful_martial_arts Instagram or Facebook, Sean Desjardins. Any of those work.
We are posting all the personal links to get in touch with Sean as well. They are being posted here. And thank you, Sean, so much. Wow. Really, thank you so much for sharing your story, being so vulnerable. And it's been incredible. But the time always kind of limits us. There's a next session coming up on self-engineering tools for COVID-19 times. And I would also encourage everybody to go and subscribe to the library to have the success to, because there's a lot of reflection in these talks as well. You know, once you have an access to these recordings again, to be able to dive into it and reflect over it, it takes us on another journey. And anyways, any donations, the links are posted here, and it will be a thank you to this whole team who came up with this amazing conference to reach out to all of you. And Sean, I would like to ask you, if I ask you one top tip which you would have to share with our participants to stay embodied, what would you say about it? What tip comes to your mind?
I would say, you know, don't be afraid to use your voice. If something feels off, it doesn't feel right, or if you have a need, see if it can be met. You know, try to test the waters. See if it's possible that your no's are respected and your requests are honored. And if they are, move forward with those people. And if they're not, it might not be the right environment for you. So you have to, I feel like, I shouldn't say you have to, I feel like it's important to, you know, take some chances to figure out, okay, is this an environment which I can grow in? Or is this an environment which is gonna break me down? And communicating, I think, is a great way to start with that. Trust yourself.
That's where the mindfulness comes in. Thank you so much, Sean, for this incredible session, and thank you, participants. Thank you, Georgia, for coming up and asking your queries. Thank you. Make sure that you get all the links. There's still time. You want to copy paste something, you want to get all the links.
Yeah, feel free, reach out through my website or Facebook, Desjardins, or Instagram, Mindful Martial Arts.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. Like, I felt myself being held in the presence of everyone here, and I appreciate it. It helped me go deeper into my own, you know, experience.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Mavi, Dan, Georgia, and all the other participants. We'll see you on the next session. Bye-bye.